start using cutting-edge Warp Speed 5G technology with your cell phone. Let me tell you about my friends at mobilemobile.io. They have an ultra-fast 4G LTE and 5G network that covers 99% of Americans. So they've got you covered everywhere. Think about it for a moment. You have the opportunity to take a test drive for 10 days with unlimited talk, text, and premium data. What is premium data? Premium data is an allotment of a cellular data that you receive from a higher priority on the network. You won't get throttled like you will with some of those, well,
non-brand
service providers. To find out more information, all you have to do is go to mobilemobile.io. That's mobilemobile.io to start your 10-day free trial.
Welcome to Safety FM, where we talk about safety that's truly inspired by you. Hello and welcome to Safety FM. I am Jay Allen. We're coming to you live from the Westin Fort Lauderdale Beach Resort in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. We are coming to you from the Federal Transit Authority Drug and Alcohol Program National Conference. Today, we're going to sit in on question and answers with the experts. The panel consists of the following: Mark Snyder, Chief of Inquiries and Audits from the U.S. DOT Office of Drug and Alcohol Policy and Compliance. Joseph LaGrain, FTA Drug and Alcohol Auditor for Cahill Swift. Juan Jose Moya, Drug and Alcohol Program Manager, U.S. Department of Transportation. And Ian Rosario, Federal Transit Administration Drug and Alcohol Program Manager.
This is your opportunity to ask questions of the experts. Who's going to start us off? All right, thank you today for a session. Here we go.
Hold on 1 second here. When you have a question, if you could just wait 1 moment for John Stillman to run up the mic.
Literally 5 minutes before the session started, I got a text. What's the position on making people, did they take off heavy coats and so forth? What about wristbands and headbands?
Anything that the collector believes they might be hiding something, the answer to that question is yes. But if it's a normal collection, they don't have any reason to believe. For example, a turban, right? A person comes with a turban. It's under religious rites. You don't take it off. If you see like this hanging out of it, you might not take it off. So the question, the answer always is the eye of the beholder who is the collector, that they believe that the owner is trying to subvert the test and bring something in with them. And then at that point, they need to document it on the chain of custody form.
I think that's what you said.
I can see.
I would add to that that in my experience in the field, collectors often expect that the regulation and DOT tell them every little tiny detail that could happen and how to respond to it. But as Mark said, you have to use your discretion and your professional experience as a collector to tell when something's up and if something's fishy and then move forward accordingly.
And further on that question, and I think it usually comes up in this session, I'll just beat everyone to the punch. The definition between a direct observation and a refusal to test at the collection site. So someone comes in and brings something with them, and the collector identifies it, correct? The regulation says if you bring some type of device or prosthetic in, that's a refusal to test. But what if you come in and, for example, not too long ago, a guy came in with a small vial of urine instead of his son's, he was taken to the hospital after he left the collection site. So what's the answer to that question? Well, the answer to the question is, once again, is the eyes and beholder of the collector. We're not expecting to know everything to beat the test, but the bottom line is if they find something that they believe is like an adulterant or a substitution of material, they have two options. Number one is go straight to a direct observation, or number two, call refusal. But either way, they're going to document it, but they're not going to collect it normally. I mean, something's going to happen where you're going in, the same gender's going to the bathroom with them, or they're going to write it up and call the DER and say, this is refusal to test. And that's what we expect of the collectors. We don't want them to try to make a final determination because they don't know every adulterant out there because there's so many of them out there. So all I'm saying, when it comes up to it, we ask the collector to make an informed decision and move on. And no one, George, Ion, no one's going to question them at that point as long as it's a DO or a refusal.
Well, I'm going to speak to that because we get a lot of those requests.
they actually, you got a situation like that, you sent a downgrade request that what we call to change the test. And this is only for positive, verified positive test. Because the problem is when positive is positive, right? So that's, we review, we do some research, we verify, and you know, we provide an answer to that. Yes, you know, we approve it or disapprove it based on the facts.
Yeah, and it's the same process for me over the TA side. What I asked for, you just send me something. I asked for an email with all the information. I need a copy of the custody control form, a memo stating why you're asking for this. Give me any justification that supports why you're asking me for the DOT to non-DOT. And then I review it, make sure everything's right, or if I may have some further questions, I'll email back, and then from there, we decide, like, downgrade or no downgrade.
As a follow-up to that, how do you, what do you do then with that employee? Because at that point, once it's downgraded, he does not have a DOT violation.
That is up to your agency policy. So he's already non-DOT, so there is no sanctions or consequences from the DOT side because he's not DOT. That should be something that you have spelled out in your company policy. And if you do not, of course, we highly recommend that you do.
And we actually request any corrective action to prevent this from happening in the future, because one of the things we get many companies, they're repeated offenders, so that's a problem of communication. So make sure your driver knows where he's getting tested for, and make sure the collector knows. But yeah, we request to have that because it's time consuming.
I'm glad you said that, because one of the things I put in the bottom of the letter is that at this point, I'm going to ask you to, if it was a supervisor error, to do some refresher training with your supervisors. If it was a clerical error where you guys should have never put him in your DOT random testing pool, I'm going to ask you to look and make sure you are making sure your random drawers are accurate and up to date. So there are a couple of clearinghouse, if you will, or cleaning house issues, not clearinghouse, but cleaning house issues that you guys need to do once that is determined.
Could I ask a follow-up to the lady who asked that question? Was this a CDL driver, or what type of function was this person performing?
Well, I guess I was more saying along the lines where this person is regulated,
okay.
So they are regulated under one of the modes, say, and they let's say they're a pipeline, okay, but they have a CDL as well, and they test positive on a post-accident that the collector, same thing. This guy has a CDL. I'm checking off FMCSA because I'm the collector and I see he has a CDL as his identification. But it didn't meet the requirements of FMCSA. He was working on the pipeline. It did not meet the requirements of a pipeline either. So now he has a DOT test. He is a regulated employee, but neither one of those, didn't fall under either mode that he's regulated under. So then you have actual knowledge that someone's tested positive, and I guess that's kind of where I was going with that.
Well, the reason why I brought that up is that even if Juan or Ion were downgraded, if he has a CDL with a medical card, he would still be medically unqualified because he hasn't, because it says any positive drug test is not a regulated drug test, so you would still have that person have to go back to the medical examiner to be reevaluated, and then whatever the medical examiner does, then that's the only way that person gets back into safety sensitive functions.
All right, I have two questions, one based on that as well. If I have a negative that needs to be downgraded, do I need to contact the DOT to let them know?
No.
Okay. And then I'm with Lorraine Maintenance Away. We have just a couple of people that fall into the FDA pool. Most of ours are in Maintenance Away under FRA. If we have an employee at some point that needs to do some FTA work who were previously provided the pre-employment grandfathering from FRA, do they need to do an FTA pre-employment before they do the FTA work?
Does anybody know the grandfathering? Yeah, I mean, within the employer, if you've got one valid negative pre-employment test, they can move around within mode of work. That's fine. The one, is Jerry?
Jerry's right behind you.
I don't know about how the grandfathering part works. Jerry's literally right behind you.
And
Jerry, perhaps stand up.
Thank you for the mic.
Yeah, the grandfathering would only be on the FRA side, so they were going to do FTA work. They would have to get 655 would say you need a valid hearing more than just. The grandfathering on our side is basically for it's just the way the covered service in the 80s were grandfathered. They didn't all have to line up and get pre-employment when we started the rule. We're giving that same benefit to the MOW. So it wasn't, you know, June 12th last year, we didn't have 40,000 people get a pre-employment test.
Sorry to wake you up, Jerry.
Okay, so back to the scenario where it was a DOT that you're going to downgrade to a non-DOT. How do you handle the statistical report when you get audited and they, you know, they look at it and they see this, and maybe it was a post-accident, they're going to want to see the paperwork. Is that sufficient to show that you allowed it to be downgraded, and, or is it going to cost something to the employer?
Well, actually, what our office does, we provide a letter approving or disapproving. You should keep that on your records. And if it's not graded, then you shouldn't report it, right? Your statistical data is just a DOT test. So.
But it might already be on it.
It might already be on the statistical report you get twice a year from the lab, depending on what time of the month, six months it fell on. And that would not be like an unauthorized test because you did change it for us?
Well, we just provide that information, so downgrade the test. When it's downgraded, and we don't downgrade it, you get a response not to downgrade. So we just provide that, so is the employer incurring that it's a violation? So if it's already reported and there's no way for you guys to change it back, so it's up to the employer's responsibility to go back and make sure everything is accurate.
Are you talking about the MIS report?
Yes.
Okay, so you wouldn't report it. You don't necessarily use the statistical summary reports to complete your MIS report. You use the numbers of the actual DOT tests for the calendar year. The statistical summary report is actually not a good thing to use to fill out your MIS.
Okay, but if they ask for it, they want to see it.
Who's
whoever the auditor is, they want to see the statistical report from the laboratory. It's going to show it.
And that may just be for FYI, but as Ron says, I know he said he issues guidance in the memo that he requires, gives back, and so do I, to keep it in your file. What our audit team will be looking at is what's in that file. If there's a memo in there from either myself or one, then we know that that test is a non-DOT test, and as Mike said, that's not going to count on your MIS either way, so let's not get hung up on the statistical report information, more so what actually happened during that calendar year, or that testing period.
This is actually for Juan. Considering the drama that's going on with the National Registry website right now, is that going to have any impact at all on the clearinghouse and the work that's being done on that system? It seems like you got computer stuff going on.
Well, let me tell you, these two different systems is managed for two different offices within the FMCSA. So, I know the National Registry has several issues. I don't know the specifics because I don't work in that office, but, we're moving, we have the same target date, and we're expecting, the system be operational. So, it will not affect what's happening with the National Registry, is not affecting that, or clearinghouse. I just put it that way. Good.
Okay, so for collector errors that are made on the ECCF or the CCF, I know there's some parts that us, the employer, can change by initialing and changing it, like a social or their date of birth and their name. So we can change that on our own on the ECCF and the CCF. What type of errors can't we change?
change anything that happened at the collection site, for example, like the temperature, checking the temperature, yeah. Or split, and then anything else that might have happened, you know, if a person said that they did something to me, you can't write in comments. You know, that's a collector's thing. But you know, you certainly can change things that were wrong that you know demographic-wise.
Okay, and like, you can change
the
word.
Sure.
Yeah, you can change
yep, you can change all that.
Okay,
yeah.
So you don't need a memorandum of record for the collection.
Right, because on the ECCF, it's unfortunate if it's wrong, because someone has edited that data in there wrong, you know what I'm saying?
And that's happening. So how do we correct that?
Well, I would go back to the collection site to make sure that, because you know, I think a lot of times when you can send ahead that this person's coming in, so it's already pre-populated, so it's wrong, we want to make sure that they say, hey, this is wrong. Once you know it, send it back to the collection site, say, you know, instead of 10-24-63, it's 10-25-63, or the social or the employee ID number. So whatever's wrong, that then knows that they can put it in there and pre-populate it, so the next time the person comes in, it's true and accurate. Also remember that, you know, none of those things, anything we're talking about here, would not invalidate the test. So just if FTA came in, they would just go to the collection site and say, well, you know, what the hell are you doing? You know, you're right. But I'd have a real problem with the ECCF. You know, if it's wrong in there, you know, it's only because someone at the collection site had to do it wrong, because I'm sure whoever from you guys are sending the proper information, because it's a driver's license they're usually looking at.
Well, I mean, we order the test, sometimes it's off-site, mm-hmm. and depending on what our different departments give us, like a social,
okay.
And if they have it wrong, then we have
okay,
it.
So what you're saying is that potentially you're getting it from human resources,
yeah.
And they got the wrong information. Okay, that makes sense. But make sure that if you're using an ECCF, when it's wrong, to let the collection say no, it's wrong. And that way, whatever they get next time, they're going to have to call you back and say, we got two different numbers, which one do you want us to use?
And I just want to add to that, when the clearing house is fully implemented, we're going to require CDL stipulations, right? But you guys need to, you know, now with that, those sprints that you have in, you know, with wrong information going into the CCF, you need to revise your policies and procedures to make sure when that time gets done, you can do your best and provide accurate information. That's just a recommendation.
Mark, I have a question for you. About a month ago, we had a fatal error that was caused by the collector, where the collector should have been gone through error correction training, and I went back to the MRO to say, are you going to contact a collector or do you want me to make sure that that gets done? He said, well, they don't need to go through error correction training.
What do I do
when I get that kind of crap?
Well, I would go right to the collection site. What was the error?
Don't remember.
Okay, well, maybe it was a fatal flaw, right? Caused it.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, so I would just go back to the collection site, talk to the collection site manager,
okay.
Go into 40.199, was it 199, the fatal flaws, cite that, and then cite the regulations on the collection site of how air correction training has to happen. Now remember, under certain section 40.203 to like 209, it talks about what causes the test to be canceled or not be canceled, not corrected. Air correction training, a collector not being qualified, does not cancel a test. It's a regulation violation, but the test is, so always remember there's seven errors of fatal flaws under 40.199 that always cancel the test. Everything else can be corrected. So if it doesn't go to 40.199, somehow it's going to be corrected.
Hi, I'm rewriting our policy and I'm taking a look at the 0.00 to 0.02 alcohol numbers. I know it's not DOT, but someone mentioned in one of the sessions that the equipment has a hard time distinguishing between acetone and alcohol, or that the equipment can't necessarily be depended on at low levels. So I want to be kind of cautious about the discipline that I'm considering at that level, and I just wanted someone to comment on that.
Well, as you know, our regulations under Part 40 and all the metal regulations, anything below 0.02 is a negative. So whatever you did would be a non-DOT sanction. And if our regulations thought, well, it seemed like a negative loop. If you want to handle a negative loop, we'd say you cannot reference the DOT regulation whatsoever. So if you go outside of it, your policy is going to have to be clear that anything below 0.02 is whatever name your company. That's our decision to go ahead with that sanction.
Absolutely.
Just don't reference us.
I will not. I'm wondering about your experience that I haven't really about the equipment and the dependabilities. Someone made a comment about the dependability of the equipment.
I think it's each machine EBT is different. You know, we're not talking about the saliva devices and stuff either. But the EBTs are manufactured different, and at the level they detect, because, for example, you know, if police officers, they look at, I mean, your regulation is one, right? Any measurable amount of alcohol?
Yes, below 0.04, you should place a driver out search.
No, I'm talking about 392, which is the side of the road.
Yes.
And they measure about that alcohol.
Yes, exactly.
So you have to say whatever the machine is, and if you ever have a question, I have to call a manufacturer and say, what's your reliability, what's your QAP say, what's reliable of anything 0.02, because a lot of times they'll tell you it's residual that's in there. I mean, but there's so many different machines that I would not even, I mean, you go to the Intoxicator where they have like 15 different ones on the CPL, the conforming products list, so I would not, I would just go with whatever you're buying, call a manufacturer and say, here's what I plan on doing. Can you help me in court to ask that question? Now you're going to get this. I don't think we want to do that. Just be careful that below that 0.02.
Yeah, and
keep your counsel in the loop as well.
You know, and I always highlight the importance. I know that we don't do a lot of alcohol testing because we require 10% but it's very important. Time is critical, and making sure whoever is doing your alcohol testing, you know, they have the equipment calibrated, they have up to date, because in many occasions you send a driver and the equipment doesn't work and time is sensitive. So sending somebody else somewhere else, we change from a 0.4 and above to below that. So, and that's a big difference because the consequences are different. So make sure you revise that with your collectors.
All right, we have a question from the online.
I'll get you.
If a transit authority receiving 5307 monies wants to be a mobility management call center for seniors, the drivers will be volunteer driving non-CAN vehicles. Does anyone know what a non-CAN vehicle is? Not sure.
I think it's non-CDL, but it autocorrects.
Oh, okay. No spell check, I guess. We'd be receiving 53 monies for this. Would these volunteers be required to be in our drug and alcohol program? So we're talking about volunteers, 5310 monies, non-CAN drivers. Well, it says the transit authority is receiving 5307 monies, but they are going to be receiving additional 5310 monies. So they are already providing a service with the 5307. They're providing a new service based on the receipt of 5310 monies. So in other words, now they're going to be providing the elderly and handicapped under 5310, and they're going to be providing their basic service that they've had under 5307. So are these 5310 volunteers now required to have to be part of the drug and alcohol program?
So this is a delightful way to set up this question. Some visual aids would be really helpful for this one. So generally speaking, 5310 services are not covered under 655. However, you do get, when you have that as a supplemental element of a program that received 5307 or 5309 money, then there could be coverage issues because of fungibility. So if you are essentially providing, using that 5310 money to increase service that you would otherwise provide under 5307 services to the community, that would be covered. Now that said, if you're using volunteers and they are not receiving remuneration, i.e. reimbursement, in excess of actual expenses, so mileage or whatever, if they're not receiving that remuneration and if they don't have to have a CDL to operate the vehicles that you're using, and I believe you said they were non-CAN or non-CDL.
CDL. So
then those people would not be covered. They wouldn't even be covered in the straight 5307 operation. So there's a couple elements at play here, but it sounds like it would not be covered.
FTA post-accident, ancillary vehicles that are rented. FTA post-accident, ancillary vehicles that are rented.
The answer to your question was it should be non-DOT. We discussed it at lunch time.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And if anyone wants to know, please see us after.
This is a direct session where you can talk about rented ancillary vehicles. That's 5%.
Has anyone gotten any feedback or any questions about what you're going to do with employees who have been on opioids and now are being asked to change their medication and are going through withdrawal?
Great question. The first thing, the MROs we've talked to, when the treating physician had no clue that the person was performing safety assessment function, has agreed to go ahead and change the medications to whatever it is, but it's not going to be one of the synthetics. They had warned them, remember, you know, especially like the one I heard is that the one guy's been taking Percocet for 3 years. So the MRO called the treating physician and said, well, I never knew the person was up. I'm not going to tell you what they did for a living. It's sort of scary. So I did not know that. He said, I will take them off immediately. And the MRO said, remember, there's also some other issues going to be involved with potential withdrawal. Have you talked to him about it? He said, the treating physician says, yes, I have. And the person says, I don't have insurance and I don't have any sick leave. So I'm going to have to gut this out on my own. The same thing problem we have in the substance abuse professional arena. Do we have people in rural areas to find a staff to start with? And do we even find people to have treating things? Do we have people who have insurance? All these things have to come into consideration. So we do know that the MROs, some MROs, there's nothing in writing to say this, that said, you know, if you're going to get them off this stuff, either you want to talk them through what could be happening to them. So we can't fund anything because it'd be an unfunded mandate. But it's certainly, we believe when two professionals are talking about this issue, they would be sort of on the same page, like, you know, we got to slow play this thing, and we hope to talk to the employer saying this person might be missing some work because there's some medical issues we're dealing with. Not specifically violating any HIPAA to say we got some medical issues we're dealing with, so he might be missing some work, or she might be missing some work. Besides that, there's not much we as the federal government can do. I mean, I know that they look, if they're veterans, they can go to the VA and get all the help they need at the VA hospitals. But besides that, there's no other difference right now when a person has an issue.
Yeah, and I wanted to, Mark and I were discussing that. I had told him you were going to be in the room, and that was actually a really good question. And we had talked about, you know, talking about the VA centers, you know, with the other branches of the federal government bringing funding and streamlining programs. Maybe, but we don't know what those outreach resources will be. So just, you know, if you guys, as we move through this issue, and please keep abreast of what's happening in terms of the opioid guidance the funding that's being pushed out to the local resources, what kind of services that you can start directing your employees to who have these issues.
I just want to add something because I've been getting phone calls from MROs, you know, having issues getting information from the pharmacies and contacting personal physicians. I think we need to make aware of those drivers under those medications. You know, they need to talk to the physicians and tell them what they do for a living. They're subject to DOT testing. Talk to their pharmacy they can. You know, because you have a 5-day window. You know, it's better to fix the problem before than after. You know, and you have 5 days, and then you might be out of work for a while. So if it's a little bit work ahead before you get a test or it's a safety concern, or, you know, kind of go back to your physician, say, you know, what's going on, and that will help a lot.
You should also, when you get back home next week, give your MRO a phone call and ask them how they're going to deal with some of these issues as they come up. I talked to an MRO 2 or 3 weeks ago who was working with a physician to actively titrate someone off of their prescription because of the withdrawal concerns. And the physician was perfectly happy to switch with something, but you can't do that instantly. So the MRO is taking a proactive role in making sure that this person had a safe transition to a more acceptable drug. And to the extent that you as a regulated employer can work with your MRO just to make sure that he is aware, she is aware, that these things will come up and look for a job and make the program a lot better.
So just to piggyback on this, I'm very fortunate in Rochester, New York. We self-administer all of our own drug and alcohol testing in-house. We also do all of our driver physicals for 19A in-house. We contract out our medical providers who service both MROs as well as examining 19A examiners. So we've had a recent situation, a guy was being prescribed 240 Vicodin a month by his doctor for 2 years. And our provider ran the report to see it and showed a positive on a drug test. And under 19A, which is his medical certification in New York State, she found him unfit to drive, A, taking that amount and quantity of an opiate, that there was definitely a dependence issue and that he needed to be weaned off it when being withdrawal, and she found him unfit for duty while he was going through the withdrawal process. So we were really proactive in getting him into employee-sponsored program through our substance abuse professional or EAP program, not a DOT mandated. And then his doctor completed New York State disability paperwork and we were able to pay him disability benefits while he went through that withdrawal process.
I mean, that's what the way it's supposed to work, but unfortunately, that means that like the 5% of the employers are able to provide that kind of services. Because the biggest concern is, and I just want to talk to Juan, most of these, probably of the 5 million truck drivers out there, probably 4.5 million of them don't have health insurance and have no paid leave whatsoever. They're not driving, they're not getting paid, and no one's paying for their insurance. So ultimately, what's this individual going to do? They're going to try to gut through it themselves while they're going to withdrawal and keep on driving. And ultimately, no one can stop them. Because here's the problem. Under the medical standards of motor carriers, they did not test positive. It's a negative test. Okay? So potentially you could say that there's a change in the person's behavior, but you don't know that yet until he starts withdrawal. And not only sure if the medical examiner would be able to do it at that point. So it becomes a really slippery slope if you don't have all these factions in there, and it's no different right now, like I said, with substance abuse professionals. They're going to find the substance abuse professional that gives them education and gets them back on the road as soon as possible. They are the facts that we're dealing with, and this whole opioid epidemic is not changing. All we're saying is that we're hoping that the MRO and the treating physician have a heart-to-heart say, what's our option? Where are you located? Do you have free services that you can go to and get some help? You know, there's, I mean, depends where you live and what you got.
So my question is, I know that you do audits at some of the testing sites, so probably all of them at some time or another. But where I come from, the testing site comes to the property, you know, and do their testing on the authority on the property. So how do you conduct, for lack of a better term, surprise audits with those companies?
So for a regular audit, not surprise audit, we do have those mobile collectors come to the transit agency's facility or wherever they do it and show us how they do that collection. They do get a heads up about that. So for the undercover surprise audits that IM runs through FTA, a lot of times those are missed because where do you go? You know, IM's inspectors are in the field. And so where would you go for a mobile collection? To the person's house? However, within transit, they will often, before they do their undercover trips, they will work with the transit employer, the grantee in the area, to present themselves as a transit employee and then do a surprise inspection.
I saw your face. You got to remember, when they go undercover, they have all sorts of different employer IDs, they have all sorts of different IDs. I mean, it's pretty complicated how they do this. They get almost in anywhere. I mean, I've had them go to places where I never came in, and no one knew that they were there, came in and came out. So if an employer thinks they have a problem, the employer's going to work with them.
the employer very easy could give one of the people employer ID, right? It's not hard to find employer ID. Say, I'm not quite sure, I'm not smart enough how to fix it. But when you guys are on site for an audit, I want you to do the whole audit on that, thinking it's one of my employees. And so they come on, and you know, just a regular Joe pre-employment test, and you're going to find all sorts of violations at that time. So there's a way to do it, especially if the employer wants help.
All right, I have a question here. How much discretion does an employer have when identifying safety sensitive roles?
I'm going to say for FTA, it's clearly defined in 1655 for what is FTA's safety sensitive definition. If you want to add on to that, then that means you're now changing it to something more transferable, your agency focused. But you're very clear in what determines FTA safety sensitive definitions. We know we have five of those. So if you want to do something outside of that, I would recommend you put it in your policy and say this is covered under FTA, your agency policy.
I'll add to that too. I've been asked twice this week so far whether certain job titles are covered or not covered. FTA's regulation, Part 655, does not really discuss job titles. We're concerned about what functions you perform, what physical activities you do that affect public safety. So you can look at all of the job titles you have within an organization, go through them and ask yourself, does this person affect public safety by operating a vehicle, by controlling the movement of a vehicle, by wrenching on a vehicle? Everything has some kind of physical action or interaction with an operator that could affect public safety, essentially by busting an answer.
Yeah, and following on that, the same FMCSA is CDL. It's tied to the CDL, but it's depending on the function, it's not on the title. You might have a manager, they might once in a while drive a vehicle that requires a CDL, performing safety-sensitive functions. And safety-sensitive functions is including the driving, but also all the other things surrounding the transportation, the inspection of the vehicle, the loading, unloading, but tied to the CDL. Because a lot of times people ask, well, I got this driver, test positive, I know that I cannot, that can drive, can he do some loading, unloading? Yes, because it's not related to the responsibility of the vehicle, right? Only when it's tied to the CDL is how we did. So that's what we consider safety sensitive functions and FMCSA.
What about the person who just sometimes performs a safety, a supervisor, let's say, who will go out and pick up passengers if there's something like bad weather or a vehicle breaks down or something like that, which it occasionally happens, but it's certainly not part of their regular job duties.
So we get this question quite a lot when we go out and do audits. And what we see is, there's a couple ranges or tiers of what we see. Sometimes we'll see that the general manager is included in your safety sensitive pool, you know, for random testing. And the reason we ask why is the GM covered for this? Do they perform safety sensitive functions, you know, frequently, sometimes? And well, the response is usually, you know, they might do it maybe once a year, like a rodeo or something for promotional reason, but otherwise the GM is in there just because they have a feeling that if my guys are subject to testing, I should be too. It's a cultural thing. We tend to say that, no, that person should not be safety sensitive. The main reason for it is that you are diluting the pool of people who will be selected for random testing who actually have a real nexus with public safety on a day-to-day basis. So if your GM gets pulled, you have to send him for a test, but you know, Mike didn't get pulled, and Mike's driving a bus every single day. We'd rather see Mike get pulled. And that one time a year that he's doing the rodeo or whatever, we're not concerned about that. If you have a supervisor who is doing periodic, you know, we have this person here to do backups, maybe it's only a few times a year, but they're trained to do it, and they're able to do a safety sensitive function, then they would be here.
Hi, good afternoon. If an employee completes the SAT process and goes back to work and fails their return to duty test, what happens?
Starts all over again. That whatever happened. So here's the thing. That's a great question. So whatever, let's say that he was supposed to go through 12 follow-up tests in the next 2 years, that whole plan, everything gets thrown, I mean, it's filed, it's starts the staff process over, whatever staff says, and the new follow-up plan, only one follow-up plan. You're not doubling up on here. So he, you know, you got two positive tests, but still one follow-up plan.
I was surprised the other day, I asked some of my team members, when they're scheduling DOT tests, do people know that the test has changed? And some of my team said, no, there are a lot of people that asked about it, but they're not familiar that the test has changed. So my question is, from an impact standpoint, do you have any comments on what you've seen since January that has become the biggest issue? I mean, I know it's a short period of time, but do you see more refusals? Do you see more positive issues? I mean, have you seen something significant as a challenge since the test has changed?
Well, the, say the test has changed is more accurate to say they added more drugs to be tested for. The testing itself, nothing's changed. The collection's the same. What I will say is, it's very interesting, and it has not so much to do with the synthetic opiates. It's more to do with just we're testing, at it's more sensitivity to testing. The laboratories are finding more imbalance. More imbalance based upon what? More imbalance based upon all the synthetic urine that's out there that people are trying to adulterate the test. And what happened was, one manufacturer of the synthetic urine was worried about the synthetic opiates, so they changed the combination, the composition just a tad, so it made it a little more yellow. The synthetic urine basically is in a little bag. You put it in here, you shake it up, and then hopefully you keep it warm enough that it'll pass the temperature, but it'll hopefully mask the test. And what they did was, and don't get caught up in the laboratory words, but the amino assays, the reagent in the synthetic urine was causing it to go wacky, for better word. So at that point, then the laboratory knows there's something wrong. And so they're going to send an invalid. Now, the scariest part about this is that when you have an invalid test, by the regulations, if you don't have any reason why, the MRO is going to tell your employer to send you back for direct observation as soon as possible. Of these thousands of invalids that came back, the result of the direct observation of the invalid, 20% of them were positive. The other problem is they also know HHS, Health Consumer Services, have their own laboratory in Raleigh, Durham. They're testing these synthetic opiates all the time. There's two of them that win every time. It'll go straight through, and it'll be a negative. Now, they do have some biomarkers that they know of that they're looking at to see that, you know, as human urine has so many creatinine, specific gravity, uric acid, steroids. There's so many things that human urine has to have in its composition. And they're looking at, some of these aren't coming up with biomarkers, but they don't know what at the lowest level, but they say if you don't get below this, it becomes adulteration. So I think to your question is the synthetic urine is out there. It's always been out there. And what's interesting is that on most of the synthetic urine, it will say on there, I think a lot of them are like $15, they say if you don't pass, we'll give you 5 times your money back. So here's what happens. So, and we know this, we've made some calls. So I called the manufacturer and said, I flunked. What do you think you're going to test positive for? Let's say marijuana. Did you ask for your split? So no, ask for your split. So what they're finding out is, when you call back and say, my split still failed, they know they're getting caught. So they basically paid $75 for a high intelligence. So if it passed, they're like, all right. Because what will happen is sometimes the way the synthetic urine works, if you test it too fast, it has not had enough time to decompensate what it's trying to do with the drugs in your system. And what will happen then, after it sits for a while under the split, it will be active and it will work. So these are all the things that we're finding out working. So I know for a fact Health and Human Services is working on it. It's a big, big issue because we've never seen this many invalids in this short of time.
And I want to add on to that first part where you were saying that a lot of employees don't know that that there's something different that they're going to be tested for additionals. So that tells me that some properties are not doing their education or not informing their employees of what they're being tested for now. So something has changed, and as Patrice said, you want to communicate that to your drivers. So now that they're informed of what being required of them, because some of them are watching, everyone's watching the news. Everyone knows opioids is the issue,
but they don't understand now that they're now, some of them may not understand, you're now subject to that now. So just say if that's happening, there needs some education pieces that need to be pushed out.
Going back to the supervisors, we have supervisors that will definitely drive 2-3 times a month, you know, at least. And if they get pulled for a random alcohol, the general thought process, and I want to know if this is correct, is that because this happens regularly, they're perpetually in a state of just before performing a safety-sensitive function because they could get called out at any time during the day if somebody breaks down. So would we do the alcohol test?
You're covered by the motor care, right?
Yes.
Okay, I'll...
I know I've had those students, and some people have, but for me, it is that you say 2-3 times, right? But is that reasonable?
Some are every day for weeks.
Okay.
It varies.
So when they go to work, are they expected to take the milk from the vehicle?
Well, they don't know if anybody.
But it's an expectation.
Yeah, they have to be ready. Yes.
Okay.
Ready to go at any time.
All right.
So perpetually just
there
before.
There you go.
Just check.
I have a quick question. Let's say I have a transit system and I have the exact same situation.
we say no to that, actually. Within transit, we say if your supervisor doesn't have, you know, if they're not scheduled to perform a safety-sensitive function, they have no knowledge of performing a safety-sensitive function, they're just sitting there at their computer, then for us, they're not performing a safety-sensitive function. However, you can tell them, you can say to your supervisor, go move that vehicle, go move that revenue service vehicle from that side of the yard to the other side of the yard. And when he finishes driving and gets out of the car, say, here's your random alcohol test, the amount of questions.
I mean, it's
not devious, but it works.
My question is, back on the list, we have a random list with CDL drivers that are on there just because they have a CDL. They're not expected to drive and come to work. It's federal motor carrier. But just because they have a CDL license, our employer wants to be able to use them in case something happens and they need a CDL driver. But they're not expected to ever. They don't come to work with the expectation to have to drive. Is it okay to have them on the list?
Okay, you're saying someone that holds a CDL, works for the employer, right? But it doesn't drive, right?
Correct.
They don't have to be subject. So the thing is, at the time that person drives a commercial motor vehicle that requires a CDL, it's subject. If that person is not, even if they hold a CDL, they're not subject.
Are we wrong for having them on the list? Like, I'm on the list.
Well, it's like he mentioned, you're going to have somebody that drives once a year and have it on the pool. You know, you're diluting the pool. You have somebody that goes, you know, several times a week, maybe one time a week. You know, well, that's more agreeable.
But I guess the whole point of it is you keep them in the pool in case that one time a year happens, you don't have to wait for the pre-employment test, right?
Right.
Right, I mean that is an issue. Because a lot of people do that.
Yeah.
Because you don't know when this issue is going to come up. You know, you have 5 people calling sick one day. That person is going out the road, but if they're not in the random testing pool, you can't send them because you need to put them to the pre-employment test in more than 30 days has happened. So, I mean, as Juan's program, I just think it's tough. I've always said if a person can be expected to drive at any time, just keep them in the pool.
I haven't driven a CDL vehicle in 10 years, but I'm still on the list.
But you know why I still have a CDL? Because nobody in their right mind wants to go back to the frickin' DMV to get the license. One thing I'll say about this country, all 50 states, the DMVs are dysfunctional.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Jason. So we had a question earlier today. An employee goes for an alcohol test. The result is 0.35. The employer does not want to send them out for 8 hours. They're going to continue to test them until they go under 0.02. okay? They do the test, it's now 0.04. Is that a DOT positive at this point in time? In other words, the alcohol level was climbing, not going down.
So they did the initial test.
They did the screening, they did the confirmation, and now the employer says, in the option of either sitting out for 8 hours or testing them until they come below 0.02.
The DOT testing's over. After that, whatever the confirmation test is, that's the final answer.
Is it done on a DOT form?
Yeah.
Oh, it is, but it's not considered a... The result of 0.04 is not considered the DOT test.
No.
Okay.
Whatever comes with policy. Let me just give you real quick a story that I served customers, a real story. There was a person that drives a really big thing that goes in the air. I don't want to say what it is. And it was about 6 months ago, and they were at an airport as an overboard pilot waiting to be called on. Someone came into the overboard room and saw two bottles of vodka empty in the trash can. So someone called the supervisor. The supervisor made a reasonable suspicion determination, not based upon really anything. It's just he saw the person's eyes and someone told him. So the back came in. Now, when I tell this story, I'm not talking about 0.04. The back comes in and gives a test. The person blows a 0.42. So the back's like, you know, like, what the hell? So they unplugged the machine and started again. So there's something wrong with the machine. Plugs it back in, 0.41. So at this point, the bat, she panics and calls 911 because I ain't got it right now. Any one of us is blowing 0.41, I'm just like this, I'm dead. And you all hear the smell of alcohol. So they take him away and it's on video. The person talks like I'm talking right now, and I'm not blowing 0.41. They came to the emergency room, check him out, said, hey, he's a stinking drunk. So they give another test at a 0.37. What's wrong with the whole process? Between every test, it needs to be what? An air block, right? All they have is three initial tests. That test got thrown out. Now, the only saving grace under the another agency that has big things that go in the air. He got referred to the medical standards, then he was automatically suspended. So with the point of what Mike was saying about this stuff, there are processes here for the alcohol testing that you have initial, you have an air blank, then you go ahead and have a confirmation, and then you do an accuracy check afterwards. And if you don't have all those three things, you're going to lose tests. And then in your case, let's say it's an FTA person, you just bought this person back. You can't get rid of them. Because you got no final result, and that's why breath testing is so. Because these type of things don't happen often, because we very rarely do alcohol tests, and very rarely do we have ones that go to like this. So it becomes a difficult situation. But I was bringing this up because the way Mike's question was, they want to keep on testing. You know, this person, you could test him for the next 2 days, probably, and he still would have got
with the initial example too that Mike presented, where in the secondary testing, the person's BAC has gone up. I'm a little skeptical of that, because the assumption here is that in the first test, there was a screening test, a 15-minute wait, and a confirmation test. And if that was going up, which it almost definitely was, if the third test is up, then don't give them a test. You know, if it's going up, send them home. Don't use them later, because they're imminently on their way to 0.04 if you see them going up. It's very unusual that you would go down and then up.
And it's very unusual also for someone to do that type of testing until the person comes down under 0.02. We very rarely see that. Most people just say, go home tonight, come back tomorrow, that's it. I mean, but the question was asked, and they do this, and so it was a legitimate question.
True, and I asked, now I'm sitting up here asking, okay, so if they're doing this scenario, and they get down to below where it's acceptable, are you seriously going to put that person back to work at that point in the safety sensitive position when you get the result that you're achieving?
Yes.
That's what these people would.
Yeah. I've seen that once where someone got it down. After five tests, they got it down to under 0.02 and they put the person back on.
And you know what, Mike, what happens then? They get back into whatever the trans vehicle and go by 7-Eleven, get a
40-ounce. Oh, I do this every day, all day.
Yeah, they were afraid of losing their buzz at that point in time. So
So with the example that you just used, and I know this is probably kind of left to center what we're really discussing here, you know, the big things that go up in the air, we're sending a lot of those overseas.
That's
here in America, to wrench on those aircraft, you're under the drug test.
You said that, I did.
Yeah. Well, you
just to be clear, we are talking about Zeppelins, right?
Led Zeppelin. But to wrench on those overseas, you're not under the same, you know what I mean? And so, you know, those things are being worked on and then set back over here. So I don't know how that can be fixed, but that is an issue.
That's a great question. When it comes to drug testing, the FAA actually has a rule out to try to submit comments about testing foreign country pilots and mechanics because of that issue. But it's not going to go anywhere. It's just too many countries and too many different things you have to deal with. They tried to do this in the early 90s, and it got a slow death, miserable, die slow death. Also. Or just call me. I just told you the answer.
This is an FTA question. So I'm currently dealing with a refusal to test situation, but I did have a question about, so this particular employee is challenging that he performs safety sensitive functions. So I just want some feedback if anyone else has anyone else with this job description. This is an ITS, Intelligent Transportation Systems technician. He maintains and repairs all of our, you know, ITS equipment on the buses. And so he's been in our random pool for years and is now, had a refusal and is now challenging this. Does this sound like a current employee to you?
So this was fairly common in the early 90s when FTA's regulation came out, you know, mid 90s, I guess, that there would be, that essentially anyone touching the vehicle would be covered. And I want to say September of 96, maybe, FTA Legal determined that farebox technicians were not covered under 655. For the most part, I would put ITS equipment on the vehicle into that category, unless you can determine that there's some way that that it would affect public safety, cause the bus to malfunction operationally. Yeah, if it would cause the brakes to either fail or to actuate, cause the wheel to change, something like that. But you know, you have a human in there who's trained to operate the vehicle, at least for the near future, who's safety sensitive.
That's interesting.
Very, very helpful. Raise your hand if you have an audit.
conversation. That way you have something in your arsenal.
Thank you. Just to let you know, just before I left town, my DER reached out to someone at FTA, and they said, sounds like you sent safety sensitive to me. Oops. I can get you that.
I'm sure you did. Was it someone at headquarters at the region? Because I'm the only person
in the region. In the region.
Yeah, that's a difference. To
I think this is a good opportunity to point out a subtle distinction that you should think about when we're talking about doing downgrades for situations like this. If you have a covered employee, a legitimately covered employee, who is performing a covered function, and you tell them to take a DOT test, let's say that they have an incident with their bus, they bump their bus into a fence, but it doesn't meet the post-accident testing threshold. But you tell them, your supervisor says, I'm gonna send you for a DOT test. And your employee goes to the collection site, they consent on the alcohol form to take a DOT alcohol test. They fill out the paperwork for a DOT urine collection, they pee in a cup and give it to the collector, and that is positive. Ion's probably not gonna downgrade that just because your supervisor totally made the wrong call. This person, if that's a positive test, they violated the FTA regulation. It doesn't matter how you found out about it. Downgrades happen when you do a DOT test for someone who wasn't a covered employee. You know. Yeah, exactly.
Now, in that case, an arbitrator may overturn the company policy concerning, let's say, termination, correct?
They would overturn the consequence. They cannot overturn the
policy. Yeah. Also, the lady, I would not send an eye on any email. No, I'd take that damn one you have and just let it shine like this. FTA signed something. Just send. Don't send her an email. Man. You got to get your eyes on it. I know how this crap works.
FTA and FMCSA, we have about a little over 400 employees in each of those pools. Pipeline, we have 6. We have combined pipeline and CDL together, but now with pipeline going up to 50%, what would you suggest? Keep it there, or?
You have 6 pipeline people?
Yeah,
Oh, hell no, take them out to their own pool. Because you're talking about, what? You down to 3 tests for them,
yeah.
And the rest of them you're going to do 100 instead of 200. Mm-hmm. That's a money savings thing there, and that way you don't get lost in translation because you still have to do alcohol testing for the FTA and other carriers. So I'd break that thing up right now and just keep it that way.
So it's fine that we do it right now.
Do it anytime you feel like it.
Okay.
Call back home, fill it right now. So
okay. So my question kind of piggybacks on that a little bit. I had reached out to Jennifer Lancaster when you were out one, and I received some guidance back, and I think Mark, you can weigh in on it a little bit. We're a TPA, and we have a lot of our utility contractors who are pipeline regulated and federal motor carrier regulated. With the change going over, with pipeline raising it to the 50%, I just wanted some guidance about the alcohol testing, and I know Patrice alluded to that earlier as well. My question is, on the FMCSA side, are you planning to clarify 382.305N on random testing? Because it does say in there, subject to the controlled testing, controlled substance and or alcohol of the mode that regulates more than 50%. So that it's not clearly stated that unless they don't do alcohol, you still have to do alcohol if you put them in a pipeline pool. So
yes, and that is for employees that perform both duties, right?
Right.
So yeah, they're subject to that random testing. What I can tell you, and this is something from pipeline to put their take, because they're asking for 50%, right? For our side, you're fine, but you know, I don't know. With you might not be compliant with pipelines.
Right. See, what you're asking the question is, motor carrier is saying whatever the highest rate is. Well, pipelines has no alcohol testing, so it's assumed that if you have motor carrier people, they're going to be alcohol tested. So that regulation doesn't need to get changed because is high. There's only a drug testing pool for pipelines.
Right, but 305N says, subject to the controlled substance and or alcohol testing of the mode that regulates more than 50%. So if these are guys who have a CDL, occasionally they're driving to the job site, getting out and digging trenches. So they're in a pool at testing at the 50% rate because they're regulated more by pipeline. The regulation itself does not specify, if they're in a pool that's testing at a higher rate, you also have to add the alcohol, even though that mode doesn't have alcohol testing.
Well, because you still have to follow motor carriers. Because you get outside the pipeline regulations, there's no alcohol, and you say, what's the logical output? Motor carriers has alcohol, so these people all need to be in this pool. And so what you do is you have a fragmented pool saying, I have all people tested at 50%, and all the people that are also have a CDL have to be tagged, so I can test 10% of those also for alcohol.
Right. I understand how it needs to be set up. I'm just saying that 305
and isn't clear
because it's, and
I had
employers pushing back on me, and I just wanted to follow
through
the regulation that was
yeah. And the issue, well, with us right now, you're testing at 25%, right? FMCSA.
Yes, but these are duly regulated.
Yes.
And the employer has designated that pipeline regulates more than 50% of their.
For us, you're complying. I don't know how pipelines take that if they're testing at 25%.
No, it's the other way.
The other way around.
So,
the question, I mean, like I said, I'm still falling back because pipelines does not have alcohol testing. So there's nothing you can comply with random alcohol testing. If you have CDL drivers, you still have to follow motor carrier rules.
Exactly. But I understand that, but that's not what 305 says. It says you're subject to the testing of the mode.
The testing of the mode pipeline is drugs pretty much only, right? So you're checking that box. You're meeting that. So there is no alcohol requirement for pipelines. So the default will go to motor carrier at the other percentage that they're testing under. So you're meeting the drug only. Am I not reading that right? Yeah, so you're meeting the drug, and so this is and or at the agency that they're doing 50% of their work, which is pipeline, correct? So pipeline does not have an alcohol requirement. So that is like null and void. You can't test it for something that there is no coverage for. So then you would default go to motor carrier in that respect. They would pick up the remainder of that.
Applying the 50% of the duties. Applying the 50%. No, but I'm saying the drop.
Hey! So this actually goes with this morning's meeting. They were talking about how they are changing the testing with the MRO doing, where they can check with the smoked marijuana, with the marijuana, prescription. Is there also a way that they're testing if they have the marijuana prescription, if they are ingesting edibles? Is it like a different strain they're going to be checking on or levels?
Well, the whole thing when it comes down to the smoking the edibles, it comes up the way it's processed through the fat, and marijuana doesn't do it that way. So even though it's not smoked, it's still there's potential not as high smoke that it will come up through the THCV differential test. But the edibles also won't show up from oral fluids either. So it's a whole different animal. But so you might miss it. But I don't think you're going to be getting Marinol in with the edibles at the same time. That's just be my guess. But it could, I mean, if it's an issue, you can get down a line and find a test.
Edibles are a growing concern in Colorado right now. So.
Well, no question. I'm not arguing that. I'm not saying that. It's just when we work on things, the thing that we did this test was like 15 years old. No one knew there was edibles. You know, so you do what you do with the differential, the smoke, and so that's what you try to do with the marijuana.
All right. Juan and I had a conversation about the Federal Road Carrier Defense group yesterday. We were talking, if I get this right, maybe an easy way to say it. So if I put my
FIMSA guys do the 50 on the drug, 50%. And my motor carrier guys do the drug, 25%. And we have an alcohol list that combines them both. We do that list at 10%. Does that cover everybody correctly?
Well, the difference here is these employees that she's talking about, they perform both functions.
Right.
What we were talking, what is different is when you have employees that perform different functions under DOT regulated entities.
Right.
So the difference is that you can, when you have a situation like that, you can test to the highest rate. When you have FMCSA regulated employees, FIMSA regulated employees, you test to the highest rate.
Right. They're on the same list.
Well, you can have for controlled substances, but FIMSA doesn't test for alcohol, so you have to exclude those from the alcohol selection.
You can put, if they've got a CDL license, they're doing both. So
okay, now you're talking about the employee doing performing.
The employee is a pipeline employee, but they also have a CDL. Yeah. So if you have an alcohol list, and that employee is on the list with the motor carrier drivers because he has a CDL too, but his drug portion comes out of FIMSA, which is going to be matched or better on the motor carrier side. But
you would have two or three separate pools, which you
might have. It'd be three separate pools.
Right, it could be.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
So all the alcohol, all your CDL drivers are basically on an alcohol list, that one list. And you're taking 10% of those from action. And then the other, so your drugs are kind of separate.
Right,
so you have to put all your motor carrier guys at 50% of the FIMSA, which is a lister check.
Well, you could. I mean, the thing with it is you could have a 50% pool with pipeline only, a 25% pool with motor carriers only, and a 10% pool for all CDL drivers.
Right.
And, but all once again, all the randomness has to be met. Is how it's being drawn, how it's selected, all the rest of that stuff.
And remember that 25% is the minimum required testing. You can test to higher ranges.
We always go over a little bit, but
Well, my question is FTA is regarding thresholds, and I was just curious as to if you've had a lot of experience or anyone in the audience with. We have a lot of incident, well, not a lot, but seems to be more than usual, where mirrors will hit passing, and believe it or not, you'll have a person on the bus that says they're injured. Yes, and transport it immediately from the scene. And so, you know, we have no way of knowing if our person crossed over the line, or so we do the post-test.
So, wait a minute, how do you not know if your person contributed to
mirror
and the net person? So I'm trying to just break it down. So if you have the person said, oh, I hurt my leg when the mirror fell off. We ran and when the mirror came off on the side, hit the person inside the bus, and then they're just them being transported is not in and of itself a threshold checkbox. You have to look at the picture holistically. If that supervisor's out there is asking questions and they find out that the mirror was here, that person was sitting clearly way in the back of the bus, but I'm hurt. Well, I just felt like I'm hurt. Okay, they're sitting there, but you know that driver had no dealings with knowing that did not contribute with that. You would not call that an FTA test. That would be an over test. When we come out and audit and say, okay, you're saying everything is FTA. At this point, one of the things we would recommend is you need to fill that gap with your policy and saying, how would you guys do that? And then some refresher training for your supervisors that are making these determinations, because some things are clear, some things aren't clear. But if you have a perfect scenario that's like front of the bus, this, the person's way in the back, okay. Unless it was so jarring that person, you know, but these are all things, factors you need to take into consideration.
I would just add that you should empower your supervisors to call bullshit. We see this all the time. And your supervisors know that your bus drivers are, you may have heard me say this yesterday, generally, though they may drive you crazy, very, very good drivers. You guys spend a lot of time and money training them. They're excellent drivers. People, regular people like me, are terrible drivers. So, yeah, maybe if your supervisor talks to the people on the bus and they say, you know, the bus driver swerved over the other lane, that's why it happened. But yeah, maybe send them for a test. Don't discount the driver. But if it's happening a lot, probably it's just people, it's, you know, bad other drivers, and it's people who want to get a check from you.
Risk assessment.
Yeah, so tell them to stand up straight, document what they see, and then not do a test.
All right, I think we've reached the limit. Can we give a hand to the... We'll still be here for a couple of minutes if anyone still has a question, and we'll see you all tonight on the hotel-sponsored social.
Now, they did cover tons of information during that session. That might be one of those where you might have to go back and listen to it a couple of times to get all of the information that was covered. You have four experts there that are able to answer questions, and a lot of questions came in from the audience. Great information overall. Yes, you might be hearing some splashing sound in the background. Yes, we are in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I am taking this opportunity to do this recap right now directly from the beach. So those are the splashes. Enjoying the second to last day here during the conference. We'll be heading back home here shortly. But just wanted to take the moment to say thank you for listening to the podcast. I truly appreciate the amount of listeners that we've had over the last few weeks. If you're interested in being a little bit more involved with the podcast, you can actually come to our website at safetyfm.com. You can visit us at Facebook at SafetyFM or go to Twitter at SafetyFM. Now, I'm not sure which actual podcast system you're listening to us on, but if you do like the show, please go ahead and subscribe to our little show here, and please feel free on giving us a review. Based on whatever information you give us, we know exactly what to do, how to move forward with the podcast. Hopefully, you are enjoying it. Till next time, I've been Jay Allen, your safety manager and host. Please be safe.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and its guest and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the company. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are only examples. They should not be utilized in the real world as the only solution available, as they are based only on very limited and dated open source information. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the company. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, recording, or otherwise, without prior written permission of the creator of the podcast, Jay Allen.
So, do you feel like you're missing out on what everyone is starting to do now, that live streaming thing, and you don't know where to start or what to do? I have the resource and the information to provide to you in regards on how you can stream onto 40 social media platforms all at one time. Yes, that's 440 social media platforms all at one time. All you'll need to do is go to safetyfm.com/one. That's safetyfm.com/one. That's O-N-E. So just in case. And you'll be able to start live streaming just like you're hearing people starting to do right now, up to 40 social media platforms.